Welcome back to the deep dive. Ready
Yeah.
to get into another fascinating case.
Always.
Awesome. So today we're diving deep into Berkus v. Tompkins, a Supreme Court case that really kind of turned the world of Miranda rights upside down.
Oh, yeah. This one is a real head scratcher.
It is. We've got a whole stack of articles and legal briefs here. And from what I've been reading, this case is going to take us right into the heart of the interrogation room and those classic "You have the right to remain silent" warnings we've all heard about.
You know what's so interesting about Berkus v. Tompkins? It really shows you just how delicate something like the right to remain silent can be. You think it's so simple and straightforward, but this case, man, it gets into all these tiny details about how you invoke that, right? How it can be
Yeah.
waived, and then ultimately how the Supreme Court decides to interpret it all.
It's like one of those things you think you understand until you actually have to like really think about it.
Exactly.
Okay, so to set the scene, this case goes back to 2000. There was a shooting outside of a mall in Michigan.
Tragic situation.
One person was killed, other was injured, and the suspect, Van Chester Tompkins, wasn't arrested until about a year later.
Right.
And the real story starts to unfold during his interrogation.
Picture this, okay? Tense interrogation room detectives are grilling this guy for answers, and he's just sitting there, mostly silent, for almost 3 hours.
Wow, 3 hours.
3 hours. The records describe him as being largely silent, just a few words here and there. Yeah, no, I don't know, that kind of thing.
I can't even imagine being in that situation. The pressure must have been intense. It
Yep.
makes you wonder what was going on in his head, right? Like,
Yeah.
was he being strategic? Did he even understand his Miranda rights?
Well, that's part of the problem. The
Yeah.
records aren't totally clear if Tompkins actually said out loud that he understood those rights, which makes this whole thing even more complicated.
It's already getting so messy. So walk me through this interrogation. What happened? What were the key moments that led to his conviction?
Okay, so for almost 3 hours, Tompkins is like a brick wall. But then about 2 hours and 45 minutes in, the detective kind of changes things up. He starts asking Tompkins about his faith, like, does he believe in God? Does he pray?
Interesting.
And suddenly, Tompkins, who hasn't said a word this whole time, answers yes to both questions.
Like a switch flipped.
Right. He goes from total silence to actually engaging with these very personal questions.
Okay, I'm already hooked.
Yeah.
So what happens next?
Here comes the turning point. The detective asks Tompkins, do you pray to God to forgive you for shooting that boy down? And Tompkins, with tears in his eyes, says yes.
Whoa.
This is the moment he makes those incriminating statements that eventually lead to his conviction.
Man, that's heavy. It's like something out of a movie. But legally speaking, this has got to raise some serious questions about those statements, right?
Absolutely. So, was Tompkins' silence a clear invocation of his right to remain silent? Meaning, should the police have stopped questioning him right then and there? Or did he waive that right by eventually answering? That's the heart of this whole case.
Okay, so let's get into those arguments. What was Tompkins' defense strategy?
Well, they focused on the fact that he stayed silent for so long. They argued that his silence itself was a clear way of invoking his right to remain silent. They said the police should have recognized that and stopped the interrogation.
That makes sense. I mean, if someone's not talking, maybe they're trying to say something without actually saying it. So
Yeah.
what did the prosecution say to that?
They countered by saying Tompkins' silence was ambiguous. They said his answers, especially the ones about the shooting, showed that he was willingly participating and therefore had waived his right to remain silent. Basically, they're saying his actions spoke louder than his initial silence.
Okay, so we've got two totally different interpretations of what his silence meant. This must have been a tough one for the Supreme Court to decide.
Oh, absolutely. And their decision ended up having a huge impact on how Miranda rights are understood and applied.
So the court had to decide between these two very different ideas of what Tompkins' silence meant. What did they end up ruling? Did they agree with Tompkins that staying quiet was enough?
Well, they didn't. The court actually sided with the prosecution. The majority opinion was written by Justice Kennedy, and he basically said that Tompkins never clearly stated he wanted to stay
So
silent.
just being quiet isn't enough. You actually have to say, "I'm invoking my right to remain silent," or something like that.
Pretty much. That's what their ruling boils down to. They concluded that by answering those questions later on, he was implying that he was giving up that right to remain silent.
Okay, so to be clear, Justice Kennedy wrote, "A suspect who has received and understood the Miranda warnings and has not invoked his Miranda rights waives the right to remain silent by making an uncoerced statement to the police."
That's the quote.
Wow. That's pretty straightforward. But it also kind of feels like a catch-22. You have the right to remain silent, but you have to speak up to actually use that right.
Right. You see why people have a problem with this ruling. It kind of goes against the whole point of Miranda rights, which is to protect you from saying things that could hurt you.
Totally. So what happened after this ruling? Did it change anything about how police do interrogations?
Big time. Berkwise v. Tompkins led to changes in police training all over the country. Now they teach detectives to be super clear about making sure the suspect understands their rights. They tell them to specifically ask, "Do you want to talk?" or "Do you want a lawyer?" instead of just guessing based on whether the person is talking or not.
So it sounds like things got a lot more formal and careful after this case.
Yeah.
Like they added a whole verbal checklist.
Exactly. And this case had a ripple effect. It influenced a lot of other cases that came after it. Lower courts would look at Berkwise v. Tompkins and say, well, the Supreme Court said silence isn't enough. And then they would allow statements from people who didn't clearly say they were staying silent.
So it set a precedent that kind of echoed through the whole system. Do you have any examples of how this played out in other cases?
Oh, yeah. There's this case in California a few years later. A guy gets arrested for robbery, and during questioning, he answers some stuff at first, but then stops talking for a bit.
So kind of like Tompkins, he went silent for a while.
Yep. But he never actually said, "I want to remain silent." Then later on, he starts talking again and actually confesses to the whole thing.
So knowing what we know about Berkwise v. Tompkins, I'm guessing the court allowed that confession to be used as evidence.
Exactly. They used that clear statement rule and said that by answering questions after going quiet, the guy had basically given up his right to remain silent. And so, yeah, his confession was allowed and he ended up getting convicted.
It's crazy how one Supreme Court ruling can have such a big impact on all these other cases and the whole legal system.
It really shows how important these Supreme Court decisions are. They're not just about one case. They're setting the rules for how similar cases are going to be handled for years to come.
It makes you wonder how many people might not even know about this ruling and might accidentally give up their rights just because they weren't clear enough about wanting to stay silent. It seems like a kind of sneaky way to shift the power dynamic.
Yeah, it's a valid point, and it's why understanding this case is so important. It shows how crucial it is to know your rights and how to use them properly.
So I'm guessing there were some strong dissenting opinions on this case. What were the justices who disagreed with the ruling concerned about?
Oh, yeah. Justice Sotomayor led the dissent, and she did not hold back. She argued that this decision basically made it easier for the prosecution to get confessions that might not be totally voluntary.
So they were basically saying, hey, the guy was silent for almost 3 hours. That should be a pretty clear sign he didn't want to talk. It seems kind of obvious.
Right. Justice Sotomayor's point was that the whole purpose of Miranda rights is to protect you from incriminating yourself, especially when you're in a stressful situation like an interrogation.
And her words were powerful. She wrote, "Today's dilution of the prosecution's burden of proof to the bare fact that a suspect made inculpatory statements after Miranda warnings were given and understood takes an unprecedented step away from the high standards of proof for the waiver of constitutional rights this court has long demanded."
Wow. Yeah, she really hit the nail on the head there. The dissenting justices were worried that this ruling was setting a bad precedent and that it would make it easier for law enforcement to get confessions that weren't truly voluntary.
You can really see the tension here between wanting to protect people's rights and also making sure law enforcement can do their job.
It's that constant balancing act that comes up again and again in legal discussions.
So where do things stand now? Have there been any attempts to challenge this ruling?
There have been some efforts to revisit that clear statement rule. Some people think the court should be more flexible and consider things like the person's age, their education level, or even their mental state, because those things could affect how well they understand their rights and how clearly they can express themselves.
So basically they're saying we need to look at the whole context, not just have this one-size-fits-all clear statement rule.
Exactly. But for now, Berkwise v. Tompkins is still the law. It's still being debated and analyzed, and there's no doubt it's had a huge impact on the criminal justice system.
It's a case that really makes you think about the balance between individual rights and law enforcement, and how even something as seemingly simple as the right to remain silent can be so complex in the real world.
Absolutely. And that complexity is what makes this case and the whole topic of Miranda rights so interesting to explore. It gets into these fundamental constitutional rights and how we interpret them and the whole dynamic of power within the justice system.
So far, we've covered the background, the arguments, the ruling, the dissent, and even how this case has affected other cases. But there's one more piece of the puzzle we need to talk about. Remember those letters Tompkins got from his co-defendant, Eric Purifoy, while they were waiting for their trials?
Oh yeah, those letters. That adds a whole other layer to this already complicated story.
Sure.
They raise questions about whether Tompkins got a fair trial and whether his lawyer did a good job representing him. We'll get into all that after a quick break.
Okay, so we talked about how this case really changed things for Miranda Rice, how it created that clear statement rule. But you mentioned these letters that Tompkins got from his co-defendant, Eric Purifoy. These letters sound like a whole other mess.
They really are. So remember, Purifoy was actually found not guilty of the murder.
Right. He was acquitted.
Exactly. And while Tompkins is waiting for his trial, he gets these letters from Purifoy.
What did they say?
Well, in the letters, Purifoy is kind of complaining about being called a snitch, and he even suggests a possible strategy for Tompkins to use at his trial.
Hmm. That sounds like it could be a problem. Did the prosecution know about these letters?
Oh, yeah, they did. And they actually used them during the trial to try and make it look like Purifoy and Tompkins were trying to get their story straight. They argued that even though Purifoy had been acquitted, he was still trying to help his friend get off.
Wait a minute. So they were using the fact that Purifoy was found not guilty to somehow try and prove that Tompkins was guilty? That doesn't seem right at all.
That's the issue. It could have really influenced the jury, even though what happened in Purifoy's trial shouldn't have had anything to do with whether Tompkins was guilty or not. It raises some big questions about whether Tompkins got a fair trial.
It sounds like they were trying to use guilt by association. Didn't Tompkins' lawyer object to this?
And that's where things get even trickier. Tompkins' lawyer didn't object to the prosecution using those letters. He also didn't ask for something called a limiting instruction.
A limiting instruction? What's that?
It's basically when the judge tells the jury how they can and can't use certain evidence. In this case, a limiting instruction would have told the jury to ignore what happened in Purifoy's trial when deciding about Tompkins.
So Tompkins' lawyer missed a chance to protect his client from information that could have biased the jury. Did this come up in the appeals process?
Definitely. Tompkins argued that his lawyer messed up by not objecting and not asking for that limiting instruction. He said those mistakes could have hurt his chances with the jury.
That seems like a reasonable argument. What did the court say about this?
Well, this is where it gets really complicated. The Michigan Court of Appeals said it wasn't a big deal. They said there was enough other evidence against Tompkins to support the conviction, even with those letters. But then the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed. They thought not having that limiting instruction could have swayed the jury.
So one court says it was a harmless error. The other says it could have changed the whole outcome. What did the Supreme Court say?
The Supreme Court ended up siding with the Michigan Court of Appeals. They said even if the judge had given that limiting instruction, it probably wouldn't have changed the verdict.
So even though there were concerns about those letters and how they might have prejudiced the jury, the Supreme Court didn't think it was enough to overturn the conviction.
Right. The majority opinion focused on all the other evidence and said the prosecution had a strong enough case even without those letters.
But it still feels wrong that someone's acquittal could be used to try and make someone else look guilty.
It definitely raises some ethical and legal questions about what's fair game in the courtroom. And it shows just how important it is to have a good lawyer, someone who knows how to fight those legal battles and make sure your rights are protected.
This whole case, from the interrogation all the way to the Supreme Court rulings, really shows just how complicated the legal system can be and how even small details can have huge consequences. Berkowitz v. Tompkins is one of those landmark cases that changed the way we understand Miranda rights. But it also makes us think about things like due process and fair trials and the power dynamics in our criminal justice system.
It's a case that people are still talking about and debating. It forces us to ask some tough questions about finding that balance between individual rights and effective law enforcement.
We've really gone deep on this one. We've covered the arguments, the rulings, the dissenting opinions, even that twist with the letters from Purifoy. This deep dive has shown us just how intricate the law can be and how even seemingly minor things can have a huge impact.
And it all comes back to that fundamental question. What does a fair trial actually look like? How do we protect individual rights while still making sure justice is served? Those are questions we should all be thinking about.
So what stood out to you most about this case? Did the Supreme Court make the right call? How do you think this ruling affects that balance between individual rights and law enforcement? We want to hear your thoughts. Keep those wheels turning, and until next time, keep diving deep.